hard-hitting medical truth, cutting through conflict and confusion to the understanding you're searching for. Join Dr. Peter McCullough, world-renowned medical expert and practicing physician, for this edition of the McCullough Report. Your life may depend on it.
Let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. So much to talk about this week on the show. Wow, so much has happened. Supreme Court, Missouri versus Biden was heard on Monday, March 18th. I listened to part of it. Honestly, I am not encouraged. There was an absolute snarl of both procedural and substantive issues there. The judges like Ketanji Brown Jackson clearly was indicating that she thinks the government should be paternalistic and the government should be able to moderate content, eliminate content that the government thinks is dangerous to the public. We're talking about content through social media, on the internet, mainstream media. We heard the arguments on the other side that said, listen, the government can give the public any message it wants to, but it can't violate people's individual free speech when they post something or they link to a manuscript or a video. And I don't think this is going to end too well. I know there's hope for free speech here, but I think we should brace ourselves for the worst, that in fact the Supreme Court will side with the Biden administration. And it may be game on for government censorship, and now is going to be the time for independent media. Although I had a conversation with Malcolm on our platform. I said, Malcolm, listen, if this is decided in favor of government censorship, the next step could be government agents coming to America Out Loud and saying, listen, we don't like your content, or any other independent media outlet as well. So there's nothing to say this is confined to Google or Meta, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter. This could be broad in its application the other way. So keep in the loop on this. Missouri has been renamed Murthy versus Biden Supreme Court case. We should hear the opinion and then the dissenting opinion in several weeks. Another big development is the case of Apter, Bowden, and Merrick versus the FDA, on the FDA making false statements concerning ivermectin. In a settlement agreement, the FDA is backed down, agreed to remove all its misleading information on ivermectin, including that it's only for horses and a horse paste. There was no final bench decision on this. This was a negotiated settlement. I think it is a victory for freedom. In this, FDA does not admit any wrongdoing. We know that specifically Xavier Becerra, who's in charge of HHS, and Dr. Robert Califf in charge of the FDA were named defendants. It is, I think, a shameful, dark day for the FDA, where they have to tacitly admit wrongdoing for misleading the country on ivermectin. Doctors found it useful to use ivermectin early, even late in COVID-19. Two dozen countries have it as a standard of care government guideline to use ivermectin. It's been in the McCullough Protocol since December of 2020. And sadly, Americans were misled on this. Every American acutely sick with COVID-19, high risk, outpatient, ER, urgent care, admitted to the hospital should have received ivermectin. It's safer than Tylenol. Why not? FDA played a big role. Many have said the FDA has blood on its hands. And that was a statement, I believe, from Dr. Paul Merrick, one of the defendants. Next big news item is Kate Middleton, the Princess of Wales, announces she has cancer, and it's in her abdomen. She's had a two-week hospitalization. She put out a video. She said that the situation is that it wasn't determined to be cancer prior to an extensive surgery. Then the surgery is done. Later on, the histopathology confirms cancer. What could it be? I think it's pretty unlikely for it to be a female reproductive, that is cervical, uterine, ovarian cancer, it's almost always known ahead of time. We don't do an exploratory surgery and then figure it out later. Unlikely to be colon cancer because there's always endoscopy and diagnosis that way. The only type of deep abdominal cancers, which would take a surgery, almost an exploratory surgery, extirpation, and then diagnosis, would be something at the hepatobiliary pancreatic junction. That means the bile duct, the ampulla of Vater, the pancreatic duct, the body of the pancreas itself. I think that's most likely. And she said, well, she's had the surgery and she's gone right into chemo, which if it's pancreatic cancer, it would be gemcitabine as the lead cancer there. It's not very successful, but it's the lead cancer. She put out a video. You can look at it yourself. She looks pale, withdrawn. She doesn't look terribly hopeful. And so that also makes me think a serious prognosis cancer, that is a bile duct cancer or pancreatic cancer more likely. There are forms of omental sarcomas that I've seen arise, and certainly they can be difficult to treat. Retroperitoneal sarcomas, although that probably would have been diagnosed by biopsy, also very difficult to treat. But what's the issue with Kate Middleton? Is she took the COVID-19 vaccines very publicly. And so her case is going to be watched. And already there's comments out there by medical commentators who are concerned about turbo cancer. Turbo cancer is a cancer that arises after COVID-19 vaccination, and it progresses at a much more aggressive and rapid rate than what we would usually observe. This is probably one of the best terms that's come out of the pandemic. Do we know exactly that COVID-19 vaccines cause cancer? No, we don't. It's early in the evaluation of the vaccines. The FDA says we have 5 to 15 years of observation after the last shot to observe for late side effects, including cancer. That's in the FDA regulations. And so we simply don't know. Her case is going to be watched very carefully. But if you were to ask me as an internist and a medical specialist, I'm greatly worried that it's pancreatic cancer, cancer at the ampulla of Vater or the hepatobiliary duct. And then I think secondarily, potentially an omental form of a sarcoma or unusual tumor. Whatever it is, it isn't good. And if it takes an abdominal surgery and 2 weeks of a hospitalization to get started on cancer, everybody in the UK is worried. We're worried for this young mother, the Princess of Wales. She had her whole life ahead of her. And one can only surmise, would she have been better off without taking a COVID-19 vaccine? She was young and she was thin. The vaccines were not medically necessary, not clinically indicated. They should never have been applied to young people who had a negligible risk of serious COVID-19 complications. Yet, as a public figure, she was held out as an example, and she was actually photographed taking the COVID-19 vaccine. Final update, I think as an early read on Missouri versus Biden, boy, there has been a crackdown on censorship in social media. I went on with podcaster Matt Kim, and at 46 minutes, his entire YouTube business went down after Matt and I had a standard interview. And he was shocked. I think he didn't realize how aggressive government censorship is trying to suppress any information on early treatment and on vaccine safety. Greg Bolden of Emboldened America Emboldened on our platform. Greg and I hosted Kayla Pollack, a young mother with a 9-year-old son in Toronto, Ontario, who's fully paralyzed after her third Moderna shot. She has extensive transverse myelitis. This is an incredible interview. You've got to go over to Embolden America and listen to this interview. This woman has type 1 diabetes. She's very intelligent. She's very level-headed. She's trying to navigate now with expensive electronic wheelchairs and service dogs and other ways to help her get through life, trying to manage her insulin pump. She has pressure ulcers and all kinds of complications of being paralyzed. She's gotten minimal treatment from the Canadian government. She was gaslighted when she presented. They actually thought that she had a psychiatric problem, and yet she was physically paralyzed. This is stunning. She recorded it all. But what really made my jaw drop is when she told me that the Canadian government's answer to her problem was MAID. MAID is Medical Assistance in Dying. They essentially offered her euthanasia or assisted suicide. This is a stunning development. You have to listen to it on Greg Bolden's show. We were on the entire time. Kayla has a Give, Send, Go. I donated to it generously. My heart was absolutely broken about her situation. Please take a listen to this. Now, for the rest of the show, we are going to feature Dr. Brett Barker. And boy, is he a firebrand. He's a doctor of nursing practice. He was on the front lines during COVID. He has a tremendous amount of experience at the bedside. He's published a series of books. In fact, he's published a book where it has multiple editions. So he updates it. Very intelligent thing to do through the pandemic. We'll feature his book. He'll present it. Give us his insights. I think you're really going to like him, Dr. Barker. So let's get real. Let's get loud. On America Out Loud Talk Radio, this is the McCullough Report. The wellness company is offering the Signature Series Spike Support Formula. The wellness company supports this formula because it's designed to remove spike protein from the body. The Spike Support Formula is designed to help the body catabolize the spike protein, begin to remove it through its natural mechanisms. So go to twc.health and check out the Spike Support Formula. You can use our promotional codes or go through our banner bars on our site to get promotional codes and discounts on your purchase.
Millions of Americans are needlessly suffering from the long-haul effects of the toxic spike protein. Dr. Peter McCullough and his team at The Wellness Company designed their spike support formula to counteract harmful spike protein from COVID-19 and vaccines so you can feel your best. Go to OutLoudCare.com today and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order.
Cholesterol, blood pressure, blood sugar, inflammation, and weight. These are all real-world problems that 87% of Americans are struggling with. Often, there are no symptoms, but left unattended, we become inundated with one health problem after another. It's time to fight back with HealRight. HealRight is a bar that you eat, but it's food as medicine that addresses the nutritional root cause of health issues in just 8 weeks. Developed by world-renowned scientists and backed by 15 years of research, HealRight is effective, but it's also delicious and works without additional diet or lifestyle changes. Step out of the statistics and use food as medicine. Visit HealRight.com/OutLoud or AmericaOutLoud.shop and use the code OUTLOUD for 20% off.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is the McCullough Report, and I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. It's a great pleasure to invite to the show for the first time somebody who I know. I've known him for quite some time. We've been communicating. We had a chance to meet out in California for real. And he's got a book to tell us about, and that's Dr. Brett Barker. Brett is a doctor of nursing practice, and he's got a ton of experience, and he has the coolest book. Brett, welcome to the show.
Hi, Dr. McCullough. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, why don't you fill out your background first? Tell us a little bit more about yourself.
Oh, so a little about my background. Healthcare is my fourth career. I was in aerospace, military, aftermarket Harley parts. 2003, got into healthcare. Since then, I spent 18 years working in critical care. I started out in trauma ICU with a level one. During that time, I also taught 10 of those years at the community college I first went to for my first two degrees. I taught clinical theory and trained over 200 nurses. Like I said, working full-time and went to school 12 of those years and earned 5 degrees, including my clinical doctorate. Did some editing with textbooks for Elsevier, case studies, test questions for physicians, nurse practitioners, and pharmacology drug calculations and those types of things. But a bunch of stuff behind me. So that's the short of it.
You're a glutton for punishment. How can
yes.
you just like studying and studying and studying, huh?
Well, learn, practice, teach was something I learned back in the military.
There you go. Or sometimes in medicine, we say lifelong learning. So it's our field, we're always learning, but it's kind of like a hobby, you know? So, you know, ultimately clinical medicine becomes a hobby. We're always, you know, responding and straining to things. You know, some new issue comes up every day. So what do you do day by day now?
So day by day, I pretty much help people with whatever health conditions come up and do some consulting and a lot of training for providers and educating. I've been fortunate to train over 100 providers on utilizing the methods in my book since 2021. And so, you know, the people that I've helped in touch personally is minor compared to those that have spread it out, whether they were, you know, affiliated with America's Frontline Doctors or FOs. Fortunately, I've been able to help their family members recover from COVID. Well, they know it works, themselves and their family members.
Well, that's terrific. Now, do you work at a hospital or a clinic or independent?
No, I don't. I'm independent. You know, I have a supervising physician, and we're not really doing too much with that other than talking to people and educating and things like that. I left the hospital when I got on the plane. My last assignment of 8 hospitals during February 2020 to February 2021, I worked in 6 hospitals in California, 1 in New Orleans and 1 in Brooklyn, in the ICU, frontline with COVID patients. Mostly the flu, by the way, but that just burnt me out. I uploaded the first edition of my book before I got on that plane to leave Brooklyn and vowed to keep people out of hospital and follow things like you. I started watching you in early 2020 and Dr. Zev Zelenko and following your guides and sending you notes. You know, this is what I'm seeing. Yeah.
Hey, Brett, I got to ask you something. See, you actually worked in the ICU with sick COVID patients, right?
Yes.
How come you guys wore like hazmat suits or these PAPR suits? How come you did that?
We were told to. And then one facility, the initial starts with K and the second word is P, they would have us get our N95s. And that was it. We'd wear a PAPR if they were a special COVID patient. And we'd have to put it in a paper sack in between shifts so they could save it for us for later. It was ridiculous.
But Brett, wearing a PAPR and shields and everything, was all with the premise that you could avoid getting the virus, that somehow you were gonna skate away and not get the virus. And it turns out everybody got it.
I didn't. Never had it. Never got a shot, never had the virus, never got sick.
Really?
Really.
Then you're one of like 3% in America. Now, maybe it's possible you've had plenty of exposure and you developed immunity to it. You just never clinically got ill. There are some people who get it and it's just so mild for them. They do great. But I've always thought it humorous to see the Chinese wearing hazmat suits on the street, tackling each other, trying to do PCR testing on these poor people. And they were all pretending as if they weren't going to get it. You know, in Scott Atlas's book with Trump every day in the White House, all they did all day long was pretend they're not going to get the virus. And they were talking about like wearing masks or locking down. And it was so ridiculous because Trump already had it.
Right.
Like, and he was treating with it. Yeah. On more social distancing and masking. It's like, why don't he get onto the issue of treating the damn thing? I mean, the whole thing was just a joke. I mean, people pretending like they're not going to get the virus when indeed they did. And particular people wearing hazmat suits when they already had COVID. It's like the whole purpose of wearing a hazmat suit is because you think you're not going to get COVID. I mean, it's just was absolutely ludicrous. So you know what the CDC said recently now is that it's just like any cold. Do you see that?
I did.
So the last week I had when people are in their 90s, they had been reclusive for the last few years. They finally got COVID. They were in my office, had another, saw people point blank, no mask, nothing. We're fine. So, I mean, all that stuff was just choreography. It was for show.
For fear, right. The analogy I can make is I did serve during the 92 LA riots after the Rodney King burglary, when I was in the National Guard. And we rolled into town. We were given flak vests. We were given face shields, batons. We had ammo for our 45 caliber weapons. But it was not about, nothing can't stop a bullet. But we looked tough. Mm-hmm. So it's all about the fear. You know, here comes the authorities. We're going to get you. You need to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would have loved it. I talked to Eugenia Barrientos from El Salvador, who treated tens of thousands of patients. She never wore a mask, ever. And really sick patients. And I said, what do you think about these people wearing shields and stuff in American ICU? She just laughed. She just laughed. He goes, it's just what a waste of materials. What a waste of personal protective equipment. They used to call it PPE. What a waste. It's just, it was a complete waste. You could have walked in with scrubs and a surgical mask or something, and that's it, because it didn't spread by contact. People were wearing these gowns and gloves, and you know, as if you just touched it. It was
exactly. And what I learned early on, and for years until this, was you know, if you hit a flu patient, you know, if you're within 3 feet, you should put a mask on. That was the thing for respiratory isolation. But they made up of new things.
So this is important. So I'm a cardiologist. So if we go in the cath lab or we go in the operating room, we wear a mask. You know, it turns out about 25% of healthcare workers have staphylococcal nasal carriage in the nose, because just you're around hospitals, you pick it up. Now, here's the thing. If there's an open chest wound, and you're in cardiac surgery, and then you have a big sneeze, the mask is not protecting you. It's protecting the patient, so you don't have gobs of staphylococcus go into the wound. So the mask is really about protecting others, not for your personal protection.
I totally agree. Anytime I do a sterile dressing change on a patient, or if I'm in the OR, done some oral rotation, you put on the mask to protect them from you.
That's it. And by the way, in influenza, the same thing. With influenza, you know, we had a case at my hospital before I left, of a doctor who had this. What's really devastating is a secondary staphylococcal pneumonia. So again, we're carrying staph. We don't want to go in and cough on a flu patient and give them staph as a secondary pneumonia. So even the reason to wear masks around flu is not what people think. So interesting. Well, you've learned a lot in the last few years. It sounds like you've never stopped smiling. You've never stopped taking the positive. But man, you've got to show us the title of your book and tell us about it.
Okay. So the title of the book is called Sold Out Souls, SARS-2, COVID-19, Simple Truths Ignored. And this is the December 2021 edition. It's the fourth. So I call it the Four Horsemen edition, for obvious reasons.
Okay.
The initial book came out in February of 2021, about a quarter of the thickness. So I did learn a lot during that year. I started writing it about May of 2020 while I was working on my breaks and things like that. It's not hard to sell. It's hard to sell both. It really is.
And tell us the general outline of the book.
So the general outline of the book is it's more of a textbook and a reference. It's not a case study or a clinical journal, which you're quite used to. And there are stories and explanations. I talk about, and probably the first person to write down, what the pathophysiology of COVID was, relating it to acute respiratory distress and severe respiratory distress syndromes, and how clotting affects it. Similar back, I worked in trauma for years. So I saw DIC a lot. We're using reactive protein C and things back in the 2000s and things like that. And I saw these same things in the COVID patients when I walk in and see the oxygen sensors bouncing around. Oh, they must be clotting up. Oh, no, they're not. And then you draw a test tube. And so I talk a lot about those things. I talked about the prescriptions that were the controversial drugs, hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin, and some of the hassles getting those things for patients, as well as alternatives like acyclovir. Tamiflu or valacyclovir, something to bust up the cytokine storm brewing and reduce that inflammatory load, because these people were getting inflammatory pneumonia right in their lungs with fluid buildup, so they couldn't get oxygen through the fluid, and then the blood was not carrying as much oxygen. So their blood was turning to syrup, and you put them on a ventilator, then it goes into sludge. If we talked in late 2021 about that when we talked to a medical center CMO on a Zoom call at one point. So I talk a lot about that, and a lot of analogies I use to put it in layman's terms so people understand what's going on. The way I talk about inflammation, going from a soaker hose to a garden hose, how fluid needs to get in so that proteins and white blood cells can get into the tissue, and why it's painful, and how all that works. So people really get it instead of hitting them with a bunch of medical stuff. I've read my share of journals. I've written enough papers in 12 years of college that, okay, I don't want to freak people out. It's already bad. They go, oh, I got to take 12 to 16 different supplements and medications. I say, yeah, for a week. That's all you got to do. So hang in there. So it's more like that. A lot of learned things I've known over the years. You know, I'm Native American, Middle Army disabled vet. I've been this way forever. People want to label me as a Trumpster. I'm like, well, yeah, I first saw him on Oprah in the 80s, but I didn't follow him until he ran for office in 2015. I've been like this my whole life. So I just want America back. I want to get the truth out there. And it was really hard. There was a lot of pressure. But for some reason, I just flipped the switch and stuck with it.
Oh, very good. Very good. Now, why does it take so many different supplements and drugs to treat this illness?
Well, everything is a recipe. You can't make a cake with just an egg. And so if you're treating inflammation, that needs to be addressed. If you're treating clotting, that needs to be addressed. And it depends on the level of each of these issues. And then you need the supportive structures and supportive supplements to do that. Example, on a chronic wound patient, let's say in a skilled nursing facility, you're not just going to put dressings on their wounds. You're going to give them vitamin C and zinc to support the tissue rebuilding, for example. So there's lots of things that need to be tied together. It is a little Chinese menu. You don't need to do everything. I advise people against that. I've had people do protocol A, protocol B, and everything on it, and all the things went in the toilet. So they just need to, you know, what are you fighting? You need to fight clotting, inflammation. You know, if you have a viral load, that needs to be addressed. And it depends on where they land in the disease process, right? So we know it's a two-phase illness, viral illness at 3 to 7 days, ache, fever, pain, all that stuff. But the cytokine storm brewing starting on day one, spike hits ACE2 receptors in our lungs, you know, they feel better at day 5 or 7, right? But they're exhausted and they're tired, and it's from that inflammation that's building up. But by day 10 to 14, that's when they start having the respiratory cancer. Because they never address it, not even taking ibuprofen, because they go, don't do that, it's going to hurt your stomach. They don't know you can take 800 milligrams of ibuprofen 4 times a day for your inflammation for a week, and it's not going to do much to you. So there's a lot of things people have heard over the years they take with a grain of salt. An example is treating a fever. I have these patients tell me, well, I'm not treated until it's 102. And I know, oh, 102.5. I said, wait a minute, in every hospital I go to, it's 100.4. That's the trigger point on every order. So educating people on what reality is versus what they think they know has been a challenge, but I try to do it with kindness and just open back in and get them treated.
Yeah, as one of the few illnesses where truly the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agents were therapeutic. There were studies out of Italy showing that. So really it did make a difference. And a lot of people use ibuprofen. My go-to was actually naproxen sodium, the blue gel caps, 220 milligram blue gel caps. They just seemed to really work. And another drug category that really was therapeutic was antihistamines. To actually
absolutely.
Forms of antihistamines. And so listen, we're not just doing this for symptoms, that this right. is actually because the virus tips off the inflammation, the inflammation tips off the blood clotting. It's a sequence. So let me ask you this: what were your thoughts when the government said, "Aha, we've got it! We've got the solution to the viral infection, Paxlovid."
Why? You're going to give me a retroviral, and then you're going to give me ritonavir, which is an enzyme inhibitor, so I can't take anything else for fear of toxicity. And then if you look at all the 80s, you know, early 90s HIV studies, patients with positive HIV got AIDS taking these things. So it was just similar to the remdesivir, you know, when they had the Ebola, they pulled it too. I've had patients take it and they call me and 3 days later, they say, hey, I don't think this stuff's working, but I had your protocol. Should I do this? I said, absolutely. They're like, oh, well, yours worked better than that.
Yeah.
Why'd you take the facts over? Well, they told me to. They didn't even really advertise it. I listened to the radio and, you know, big hospital things, oh, call for an oral medication. And we knew what it was, but they wouldn't just come out and say it. They didn't have the answer. We all had the answer. We all tried to share the answer. We were censored. I've had a YouTube channel. I put things I did when I taught at Gavilan College, different, you know, psychology and chemical dependency and, you know, assessments and IV therapy and things for 2012. And as soon as I put anything about COVID, I get a strike and it's deleted.
Right.
So we were slammed with that. We had the answers, and we know why. Because the two controversial drugs, if they worked, you know, despite other things working too on what the disease process was, they could have never got the EUA because that was the rule, right?
So you're like me, you've used Paxlovid, I've used it, I've used molnupiravir. I think we have the same conclusions. I'm fairly unimpressed. Right. I mean, if they have some activity, in your mind, what's the go-to antiviral? What do you think is the most rapidly active bang for the buck antiviral?
Bang for the buck antiviral is the combination of the supplements and vitamins, your D, C, and your zinc. I do like to use acyclovir. Mostly because it's a leukotriene modifier, an inhibitor, in conjunction with Singulair, you know, for a week or two. Dr. Chetty used it quite extensively in Africa. Yeah. They couldn't afford Paxlovid and all the fancy things. But it's all about reducing inflammation and busting the cytokines. So good old Flonase, fluticasone, our over-the-counter antihistamines all hit one histamine. Flonase hit seven. That's nurse practitioner school 101. And when it hits seven, it goes to your bloodstream just like snorting a drug or something. It is a drug. They're snorting it, goes into your bloodstream. So I get people started on the Flonase, ibuprofen, and curious, all the NSAIDs, like you talk about, all the alphabet licensing boards and certification boards in early 2020 around March said, don't use NSAIDs or steroids with COVID patients.
Wow. You know, in my book, I have a book too, you have it. My chapter on my dad, when he got sick in Dallas, it was very early on. It's actually before we knew about corticosteroids. Yeah, at least I didn't know. It was too early. But one of the things is he had Flonase. It's one of the things he had in the nursing home. And sure enough, Dad never really got pulmonary COVID. I mean, so it's interesting you said that. I thought you were going to say ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine, one of those two. And it sounds like you and I, we've treated it in so many different ways. I can clearly treat it with no hydroxy, no ivermectin. It sounds like you can too.
That was my point. And I've used both as well.
Yeah, I've used it. But you can treat it without, for sure. So I agree with Chetty. Barrentos, by the way, Chetty and Barrentos, they said, listen, we don't need these drugs. Now, ivermectin, I think if I had a choice, though, and you get it early, it does have a bang for the buck, but high dose. This most recent principal trial, you know, piddling around at 24 milligrams, what have you. I haven't used 24 milligrams in a long time. My doses are your 36, 48, or 60. I had a guy today I use 60. Now, what's your view on steroids, oral steroids?
Well, steroids work. So back to the ivermectin, absolutely. If I could get on there, I would also do it long-term because it does have other beneficial effects, like helps increase ATP in the mitochondria to help offset the fatigue from that inflammation they've been fighting. So I do like that too. And the hydroxychloroquine is wonderful. You know, besides being an anti-malarial, anti-lupus, it works at eczema, it works in so many different things, Epstein-Barr, even psoriasis on vaccinated, anyway. maybe not organic, but vaccinated patients. So it works well. I've had patients call me up, hey, can I keep getting that hydroxychloroquine? You know, can the doctor write that for me? Because it's really helped my arthritis. Well, that's one of the indications.
Right? Well, it's interesting, you know, because COVID leads to long COVID, and those who take the vaccine, it's worse. You know, I found hydroxy very useful in some of these, certainly multi-system inflammatory disorder, long COVID that's ANA positive, or people with, you know, arthritides. I had somebody today, ivermectin. This guy was struggling. He's had COVID a bunch of times, and intermittent fevers, chills. He kind of generally had this kind of head pain, mouth pain, the cutaneous syndromes that kind of linger. I put him on a month of ivermectin. I said we could go 90 days. So I think when you use ivermectin or hydroxy, you really kind of have to go for it and decide what syndrome you're treating with. Now, I try to lay off the steroids. Now, so, you know, we use steroids acutely in acute pulmonary COVID, but then I'd say the thing that comes back around that we use steroids for is pericarditis or myopericarditis, like serious.
Absolutely.
I mean, EKG changes, and I use a 3-month course. I would say this, Epstein-Barr virus reactivation with big nodes, big lymph nodes, the only thing you could manage, sometimes they're huge, is to go a course of steroids.
It reduced. I often, so somebody that has a 5 to 7 day illness length already, ibuprofen is not going to cut it. So going with the steroid, like a Medrol pack, mm-hmm. you know, depending on people can tolerate it. And that seems to work well. I like using the dexamethasone. I just like the Benadryl. It's got some of the lesser side effects, especially of a prednisone. But definitely, I've had lots of patients. I've had patients call me from the hospital. You know, I'm 88% saturation. I'm on 2 liters. They want to put me on a ventilator, give me remdesivir. So, well, you're talking to me. So if you leave, yeah, we can help you, but I can't tell you to go. I've helped people get off ventilators, coaching them at home. One in Knoxville, Tennessee, that sadly he passed away last year, but he did get another 2 years. Wife set up a hospital bed for him at home and things like that. The steroids work. I have lots of patients because of vaccines. Oh, yeah. You know, I got to go to the hospital. Yeah, I went to the doctor. They said I'm in AFib. Right? It's like, you ever had any heart condition before? No. It's like, okay. Probably myocarditis. Well, they want to run some tests. Well, great. Well, in the meantime, start the Benadryl dose back. Get the inflammation down. Your heart's swollen up. It's full of fluid. Electricity and water don't mix that well, and it's got a smaller area to beat in. Maybe if you get the swelling down, the AFib will go away. You won't have to go to your sotalols and all your different antiarrhythmics, because they are also proarrhythmic, as you know better than me. Right? I just like to fix stuff. I can talk about lifelong learning. Grew up on a little ranch and stuff. I was always wrenching on things, worked in the research and development and friendly explosives and aerospace and you know, product development and design is all R&D, from concept on a napkin to the cargo, you know, sitting on the shelf in the store, in the showroom. So getting to that root cause, you know, what's the problem? Scratching my head and coming up with the answer is most viable, and then explaining it to the people that did follow that did better. The people that didn't listen, I hear the stories later. They go to the cardiologist, right? They do the EKG, then they do the stress test, and these are weeks apart. And then they go do an echo. It's like, how do they get a valvular problem all of a sudden, right? So they're still in this, and they're on meds after a week-long hospitalization to try to get their atrial fib stable while they don't ever touch heart inflammation because they say it's not there. And then, of course, they won't acknowledge it was a protein, aka vaccine related.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm seeing that every day now. Various cardiac scenarios, and the cardiologists are just oblivious to the vaccine and its relationship. Let's talk blood thinners now, acute COVID. Tell me some strategies there. Early on, what were you doing with blood thinners, and then later on in the pandemic?
Okay, so early on, the story how I identified the scene of DIC in patients that actually had COVID, I walk into a room and you'd see 602 sensors on the patient, and they're, you know, bouncing from 72 to 86 and things like that. And they're awake, you know, they're on oxygen, they're on a non-rebreather, they're moving around, or they're calm, so they're not intubated yet. They're like, oh, they're still a little bit coherent. And it's like, that's hypoxia. No, they're not. And so, well, we can't get a reading. It's like, well, then they're clotting, because I've seen this in DSA. It worked trauma for years. It's like, well, there's no hole. You know, they don't have a missing leg, or they can't be clotting because there's no hole. Right? There's no trauma. I said, well, the spike protein, I've seen snake bites where people do the same thing. So get them, you know, an animal, right? And we break apart the clot. So there were some studies out early on they did in late stage COVID patients using TPA, a thrombolytic. Because we know blood thinners only do that, prevent new clots from forming. They don't do anything to break down what's there. You need a thrombolytic. And TPA is the gold standard other than a streptokinase, right, in the hospital forever. So I know myself and many of my colleagues at different units made sure we kept all of our PICC lines very patent. They tended to clot up a lot, if you get my drift. And we found that by doing that throughout the night, every couple of hours, just like you would flush an IV to keep it patent, in the morning, the oxygen levels actually started to stabilize. Oh. We're getting a variability because the clots don't carry oxygen. That sensor just, you know, calculates, okay, healthy red blood cell, 100%, no oxygen, zero. It's an average number. So, of course, the number bounced around. So they were all treating inaccurate numbers.
Well, what were you guys flushing the PICC line with?
TPA. That's the order.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah, Okay, so that's very interesting anecdote. Good.
Well, that's in the beginning. So, yeah, you're supposed to put it in, let it dwell, and then pull it out. But sometimes you forget and you flush it late at night, you know.
So that people are getting some systemic lytic. But later on, I was impressed by these early Italian autopsy studies that show the lungs were just full of micro blood clots. And it was like, okay, that explains a lot. So,
Nattokinase was the go-to. Nattokinase, lumbrokinase was the go-to in early 2021. I got back on everybody on that. It's been used forever. And it works. People said, well, enzymes aren't in your blood system. Okay, full glass of water, empty stomach, no food for an hour, and you give it a shot, you know, in conjunction with aspirin, but, you know, not one capsule a day, you know.
No, it does. Yeah, studies have been done with natto, I think 2,000 or 4,000 units on an empty stomach. Within a few hours, the D-dimer levels change in the bloodstream. So for sure it gets in. Bromelain, I think, it changes the prothrombin time. So for, I mean, if you can change a blood test result, of course it's in the blood. Now, Tanikawa in Japan has actually come up with a blood assay to figure out how much natto is in the blood. So he's measuring it in the blood. So yeah, no, it gets in the bloodstream. I got onto those late. I'm really kind of kicking myself I didn't move to those earlier, because it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense to use those early on in the pandemic.
Yeah, and in conjunction with that, because I think about the clotting cascade, I don't know how many times I've given this lecture to nursing students. Most of us think about the red clots. They forget about the fiberglass mesh that comes underneath that's going to make the scar underneath the scab, the collagen and hyaluronic acid, and that's what this handles. I've noticed that, seen all the autopsies, they've been pulling these stringy clots out. Once you activate inflammation and clotting and it's going through your body and there's no hole, it needs a place to land. So an active COVID infection, that gap with full fluid between the air sacs in our lungs and the capillaries, for those the technical terms, it's going to lie in there in the bloodstream. And it's going to clot up there, and hyaluronic acid creates a gel. So we saw huge tight peak pressures, blowing lungs, putting in chest tubes, because we were doing it to them. We weren't taking care of the clotting. And Vax injury, for example, which causes the same thing, that low pressure system is the venous. And that's where we're finding this stuff. The red clots, over time, our body will break it down. We're always making a breaking down clots. We get a blood test, we don't bleed in the parking lot. But the white clots will not address nearly enough.
You know, we're knee deep in the clotting now. You're listening to the McCullough Report. We're going to take a break right now. We're going to return with Dr. Brett Parker, who we're learning so much about it. You know, I can tell you he's one of these roll up his sleeves, right in the thick of it here. Really lessons learned about acute COVID-19. We'll take a break right here. You're listening to McCullough Report.
You've all heard Dr. McCullough and others share over and over the value of keeping your sinuses cleansed. It's a smart move all year, but even more so when we're cooped up inside. It's not really open for debate any longer. Those that live smart and live well pay attention to nasal and oral hygiene. Cofix RX has just the tools for the job with our nasal and throat cleanse. Click the Cofix RX banner on AmericaOutloud.shop to get 20% off your entire order. That's right, AmericaOutloud.shop. Use coupon code OUTLOUD. That's coupon code OUTLOUD for 20% off your entire order.
Use Cofix RX because it works.
Don't accept joint aches and stiffness as part of aging. Doctors at Advanced Nutrition Company, Healthy Cell, created Joint Health and Mobility to support connective tissue, joint lubrication, and reduce joint irritation with curcumin, omega-3, chondroitin, glucosamine, and hyaluronic acid for joint comfort and flexibility. And Healthy Cell's not a pill, it's a gel you swallow. Get 100% drug-free joint support. Go to HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for 25% off your first order. That's HealthyCell.com. Code out loud.
Clean, pure, with premium ingredients. Global Healing's Pure Plant Protein offers 20 grams of protein per scoop, and it's a perfect way to maintain and build lean muscle while indulging yourself. It combines enzymes and probiotics to maximize nutrient absorption, improving digestion and your gut health. Available in vanilla and chocolate flavors, elevate your protein consumption while supporting your overall wellness with pure plant protein. Go to AmericaOutloud.shop and get 15% off using the code OUTLOUD. Global Healing, giving you the power to take control of your health naturally.
Expert opinions, honest debate, and in-depth investigations are what you've come to expect from AmericaOutloud.news. We don't shy away from speaking the truth boldly and plainly. All that's missing is the propaganda that has infected legacy and social media. Get the best of down and dirty, wholesome American speak. Now is our time, my fellow Americans. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Liberty and justice for all.
Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is McCullough Report. I'm Dr. Peter McCullough. We're on the back half of a really riveting interview. We've gone through the major drug classes with Dr. Brett Parker, who has a series of four books out there that you can find and use them as a guide. This is so helpful about what did we learn through the entire pandemic. And I wanted to ask you this question. Why do you think people got fooled so much on these oxygen saturations?
Oh, that's difficult to answer. Trusting the numbers, treating the numbers. And I was always taught, don't treat the numbers. If the patient matches the numbers, then you treat it. If somebody comes in with something that happens commonly, somebody comes in with UTI symptoms. You get your urine sample, and then you treat them. And then you have the lab test that comes back in 3 days to say, oh, you either gave them the right antibiotic or not. But you don't wait. The problem is they were waiting. They said, oh, the machine's broken. In Brooklyn, they actually shut down an ICU room because they said the monitor was broken. And I walked up and I put the sensor on it and said 100%. I said, it's not broken. The patient was broken. And I tried to explain to these, but I was a travel nurse. I went back to the bedside. Even with my extensive experience, maybe you probably didn't feel this as much as me, but with all my education and experience, when I went against the narrative, that made me an idiot.
Hey,
you're discounted. You don't know what you're talking about. Instead of saying, oh, wow, I ought to think about that.
Well, let's go back to your comment about looking at the patient. What about the patient told you they didn't need the ventilator, even if there was a low oxygen saturation? So just kind of give us a sample vignette.
Little sample vignette, you walk in, you don't have any classic signs of acute coronary syndrome, respiratory distress. They have a non-rebreather on. You're not getting the saturation up, but they're breathing less than 30 a minute, usually maybe in the high teens and low 20s.
Okay.
So they're a little bit with it. We know that less than 90%, oxygen curve is a cliff. 100 down to 90, and then once you're past that, it's not viable for life unless you're a COPD or an 88. It might be goofy, but you're not going to eat, you're not going to want to talk or do any activity. Somebody with a 76% that's looking at you and following commands doesn't need a ventilator, they need thrombolytics.
Mm-hmm. So if they could talk to you, they look like they were mentating okay. Let's see, oxygen saturation of 76%. And then the respiratory rate or the work of breathing, how hard was it for them to breathe, right? Don't you think you can generally look at somebody and say they're going to tire out, right? You can tell, right?
Right, and that's the plan. So there have been many planned intubations. The beautiful thing of working 12-hour nights, giving drugs, watching results, seeing patient responses all night long for 18 years is a great benefit because you get that knowing sense, right? But you're right. You look at them, they're going to tire out. And that's when they want to put them on a ventilator. So a lot of mistakes happen. Instead of using early thrombolytic therapy to break down the clots and support them, and number one, hydrate them. I've seen this in the last 10 years. You bolus them 250 ml. I'm like, that's a cup. I mean, back in sepsis, we were giving gallons of fluid to patients to bump them up, let it drain later, turn everybody into Buddha, and give Lasix later on. That saved their life, right? Because inflammation, you're getting lower blood pressures. Another thing I watched is with the work of breathing, you knew they were getting enough oxygen not to trigger an accelerated heart rate.
Okay.
Okay, that was a big thing. So when their heart rate, 100, 110, okay, if they're really hypoxic, you're going to be in the 120s, 130s, 140s. You're going to be up there trying to get as much oxygen off those red blood cells as possible. So the viable red blood cells were saturated, but the clots don't carry oxygen. They're floating around the microemboli, and they're blocking. They're reading zero every time it goes by the sensor. So they're getting a bad number that they were trying to treat off. The problem with this is you got the person walking, talking, chewing gum, walks into the ER, 86% sat, put them on a non-rebreather, get them up to 88 or 90, and then it bounces around on them. and their blood's already syrup because they've waited 2-3 weeks because of all the fear and the civil unrest and all that stuff that was going on, and they don't, and we don't know what to do, and I don't want to go be alone in the hospital, and right. It's all the stuff that ghost towns, and there was nothing in the parking lots, by the way. The two ships were never even used. I did Brooklyn. I talked to people about that, but they're there and their blood is syrup, and now the worst thing we can do is sedate them and put them on a ventilator and do the same thing, because now that blood is going to clot up.
Yeah. So we actually increase pressure in the lungs, flow through the lungs decreases because there's so much hemagglutination and thrombus formation. Then to make matters worse, even if people survive, there was a paper I viewed on my Substack where there was some huge number, like maybe 20 or 30%. Actually, when they died, they had secondary bacterial pneumonias that weren't discovered ahead of time. Like they weren't even on the right antibiotics. I mean, this whole thing was a mess. And so, you know, what we learned in where I was working is just keep them out of the hospital. We use oxygen at home.
Exactly.
We treated with oxygen saturations in the 70s, 80s at home. Now, we didn't have thrombolytics, but we did full dose anticoagulation, and we really pushed things. And I had one physician and her husband who were in the 70s for a couple weeks. They went into the 60s when they went into the kitchen to get something to eat. And they said, you know, we're breathing pretty hard. Like we feel like we're on Pike's Peak or something. But, you know, and I kept checking with them and they could mention it. And we gave every drug under the sun, every drug, monoclonal antibodies, everything. And it just, the bottom line is it just took time. You just kind of had to, it was like, if you could wait out this process long enough, you'd win.
The one gal in Idaho that's discussed in my book, you know, she was one of the people that she was like that and started on budesonide and albuterol, NEBS 4 times a day. They would never do it in the hospital because it's only for 2 times a day on budesonide. Okay, whatever. She was at home. She could do what she wanted. Those little portable battery nebulizers are great. They're silent. You don't have to plug them in with the noise reservoir. But she would do that, puff on that thing, and she got better. She's walking, talking, chewing gum, running around. The gentleman I sent you the email with that review the other day, he's in Texas. Okay. Mm-hmm. Him and his wife live there. His wife got COVID. And they both called me, gave him all the protocols and everything to do. And she did them and he didn't. He didn't take it seriously. He winds up in the ICU, was there for a really long time and nearly died. So one day she called up crying, not knowing what to do. So I gave her a pep talk and cheerleader and gave her all the buzzwords. Told her, I did kind of like an out-of-body experience, explained everything she was looking at the room, how to look at the drugs. You used them so many times, you just know what the routine is, and who to talk to, and make friends with the nurse and the RT and all this stuff. And they got him out. Now he's been out in the hospital, you know, over a year and a half, and he's doing great. He nearly died. But yeah, the best way to avoid is that early aggressive treatment at home. But when you're told it's either Tylenol or the hospital when you're too bad, people believe that because that's what they were shoved down their throat. They say, this is new. We know nothing. None of our prior experience counts because this is totally different. An alien came down and this is happening. And so there's nothing we can do.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point. That none of our prior understanding of ICU medicine applies. We know nothing. Just take Tylenol. Now, having said it, the bad cases are largely over with now. We're just in this kind of finish out phase. Is it true that people sick enough in the ICU, do they actually lose some pulmonary function? Can some people chronically just not be at their prior level of pulmonary function after COVID?
Absolutely. They develop a pulmonary fibrosis from hyaluronic acid being deposited in their lungs, which, you know, phosphatidylcholine and lung rehab and, you know, put them on a muffler with their breathing exerciser and things. I have a gentleman in New Mexico had pulmonary fibrosis prior to getting COVID. He was on 2 liters regularly. He got COVID really bad. He wound up at home with an H tank on 10 liters a minute and all this stuff for about 2 months, did all his protocols and things. And he got through all that, started doing the pulmonary and embolotic rehab section in my book. And within a few months, he's completely off oxygen now. He's got some heart stuff, but they said, oh, you can't heal pulmonary fibrosis. Well, have to try. That's the point. We call it practice of medicine and nursing. We got to practice something.
Right. And Brett, have you referred any patients or any experience with hyperbaric oxygen for that pulmonary situation?
Absolutely. People that can get in to do that, I would suggest that. Typically, You know, there's maybe only 600 wound care centers in the United States total. And usually people with hyperbaric, they're large hospitals, it's expensive. But if you go, if you're fortunate to live by the ocean and things, you know, usually the rigs have the portable emergency ambulance, hyperbaric chambers you can use or anything like that. I absolutely promote.
Yeah, promote that. I do too. So I want people that,
along
so,
with all the other.
Brett and I have the same experience here. So listen, residual pulmonary loss of function, short of breath on exertion, had a guy like that today. Refer them to HBOT, hyperbaric oxygen therapy. Let them figure it out. I put evaluation and treat, and you know, it's not an approved CMS indication, so it's not going to be covered by insurance. Pay out of pocket for it. The Swedish have a protocol, just is the SOS protocol. It's just 6 sessions. The Israelis went 40 sessions. Somewhere between those, I think the hard shell better than the soft shell. But people remember, everything so far with hyperbaric has been positive, and it's complementary to all the drugs, the vitamins and supplements that Dr. Barker and I have talked about. Dr. Barker, do you have any final words for our audience? This has been a whirlwind tour. It's been a lot of fun.
Oh, absolutely. I appreciate being on, and I love the vivid discussions and things and being on the same page from what we saw. Back to talk about the book. So I told you it came out in 2021. So it was on Kindle, Amazon, and Barnes & Noble. Since then, it still is. And I was able to release the Audible version. And recording 9 hours is not as easy as it sounds.
Hold up the book again. Brett, hold up the book so we can
Audible,
see.
The Audible is out since the 23rd of February, so you can go on Audible and download it, and you can listen to it. And I do recommend getting a copy of the book to read along, because I made some of my own illustrations with lung issues, and there's some charts and different things in there that you're going to want. And you can download it for free on academia.edu.
Oh, you're so nice. Brett, now let me ask you, so that's the fourth book of a four-part series, so should we get all four books, or no, is it incremental?
It's incremental. It's a fourth edition.
There'll be a fifth
probably in about a month, where I'm going to have putting a lot of what I've done for the last 2 years on vaccine injury treatments, more case studies, different things in myocarditis, Epstein-Barr, and different things and how they work in supplements, spike detox, you know, complimenting on yours, what I've been doing, and what I've seen working, and talk about those things. And then, of course, suggest what other people may find that maybe I haven't done, but they should look at that too, because I don't know everything. So, you know, here, take a look.
No, but you've gone to the effort of putting together, in a sense, a handbook or a manual of stuff that can be. Listen, people are struggling with this all over the world. They want ideas. You know, we're trying to put together manuscripts here and there. They need a source to give some fundamentals of how to go forward. Such a great interview. Dr. Barker, thank you for joining us on McCullough Report.
Thank you so much, Dr. McCullough. Great to see you.
Great to see you. Let's get real. Let's get loud on America Out Loud Talk Radio. This is a McCullough Report.